Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better on this episode. In the red corner, Rowdy Roddy Piper dons some sunglasses for 50 Shades of Obey as he finds out that talking to rich people is like talking to someone from another planet, quite literally. Released in the UK in 1989, it's John Carpenter's They Live.
What do these things want, and why are they here?
They're running the whole show.
Wake up! They're all about you, all around you.
They are safe as long as they are not discovered.
I don't know what they are or where they came from, but we gotta stop them.
Stay away from me.
Leave it alone, man. It ain't none of my business, ain't none of yours.
We have been lulled into a trance.
While in the blue corner, Bill is suspicious of his wealthy Beverly Hills family. He thinks there's something weird going on. Bill is not wrong, as he finds out the well-to-do do it, well, as a gelatinous mass of writhing flesh. Also from 1989, we're joining the Society.
I feel like something's gonna happen. And if I scratch the surface, there'll be something terrible underneath.
What, you've been living with these people all your life and you didn't know anything about this?
If you don't follow the rules, Billy, bad things happen.
Didn't you know, Billy Boy? The rich have all sucked off low-class scum like you.
So what connects these two films and which one does it better? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken!
Hello, Clash Podders. Life's a bitch, and she's back in heat. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilley.
And as you just heard, we are doing They Live versus The Society, or just Society, rather. Abhorrently Affluent Altercation is the title I'm going for this week. Yeah, happy with that? Abhorrently Affluent Altercation. All right, so these were my choices, which means at this point I'd normally say, you're welcome, but we've all just watched the end of Society, so it doesn't feel appropriate.
Yeah, you're going to apologise to the listeners?
Yeah, I guess I'm sorry. If it was your first watch, yeah, I mean, come on, you're going to remember it.
And we won't do it again, we promise.
Society is on Thursday, though. It's on Thursday. The clue I gave to get us to this point, our Monday's episode last week, rich people are a different breed. Chris, you followed it up on Twitter with,
I was blind, but now I see.
Mm. Clever as well. A lyric from Primal Scream's Moving On Up.
From the Bible, okay. Before that.
Right.
It's the reference I was going for, but I like Primal Scream as well.
Well, Primal Scream are my Bible. And interestingly, Moving On Up was a song inspired by They Live.
So what?
No, it wasn't.
No, I know. I knew that.
Right. He just can't give up the point. Yeah. That's all.
Guesses that came in on Twitter. If you don't follow us on Twitter, we are at ClashPod. It's a fun place to come and hang out. So come and join us. We are also now on Instagram, also at ClashPod, where you can catch up with little bits of the show and other stuff, Chris.
Yep, Instagram stories.
Yep.
I think that's what they're called.
Chris posted his first Instagram story on his own account this week.
Yep.
And he just found out that you can see who's watched your stories.
It's creepy.
Right.
Don't like it.
You don't like it?
No.
Okay. It's why it's so popular, though. It's more popular than the actual story, seeing who's watched the story. So, some of the guesses. Possible future Clash Pods on Twitter this week. Great guesses. Saz went for Dirty Rotten Scoundrels versus Trading Places. We've talked about that.
Mm.
Great pair for the future.
Defo.
Joel Trodden and Liam Neeson. Hello. Go with Limitless versus Lucy. I like that pairing.
Very doable.
Yeah. That's a great pairing. Ryan D went with Get Out versus Parasite. Bram Bram Bigelow went with Get Out versus The Stepford Wives. I'm going to tell you right now, I've told Chris already. Victoria, I think I told you as well. I watched a film for the first time that was on my bucket list this weekend, Ready or Not.
Mm.
And that is what I want to pair with Get Out in the future.
Yeah, just I wouldn't show your hand on the show.
Right.
But we'll have a chat about that afterwards.
Okay, so no spoilers then. Right, understood. Anyway, we have a first-time winner this week. Never before won Welsh and Elsewhere, a.k.a. Gavin, who got Society and They Live. Gavin, you are a member now of the Clash Pod Society. We have our shunting on Friday evenings. Bring a towel.
Save it for Thursday.
Right then, enough about Society. Let's talk about the connections between these films, though. So, what have you got?
Oh, mine are rubbish. Just the people of Los Angeles are not who they say they are. That's it.
That's it?
Yeah. Oh, well, I've got pointless fights. So John and Frank in They Live, they have a pointless fight. And Billy pointlessly fights Ted Ferguson in Society when he really should have left.
It's fine for his life, though, isn't it?
He could fucking leave.
Okay. He does leave.
After he's had a massive fight.
After he's had a massive shunt.
All right. So that's it from you this week.
I know. I'm really sorry. I just struggled.
No, okay. Really, because I'm going to come at you right now.
Go on,
with
then.
One that I'm surprised you missed. Magnificent mullets.
Yeah, yep. True.
Yes. Very good mullets. Mine is more behind-the-scenes stuff about how and why these films got made that connect them.
Of course they are.
Especially, you know, reading around them both. Both directors made them because as a reaction to Reaganomics even. They're both made, but this they both talk about this on their respective commentary. They're both films made by hippies who spent the 1960s stoned and the 1980s angry.
Yeah, and you can see that because that's possibly why some of the messaging feels a bit naive to me because I was born in the 80s, so I'm not that surprised that people want to sell me things.
Mm. That's the world we grew up in.
Yeah. No, but seriously, if you watch Saturday morning ITV as a kid or children's ITV, that's all. I remember all the jingles to toy adverts from my youth.
Yeah.
Imprinted on my mind.
Yes. I agree. But both directors believe they are actually telling true stories just with the odd embellishment.
I'd go with that. I mean, sort of, I guess. Mm. I mean, I'm not mentioning Society, but damn, a good shunting is what I love. The Police in Your Pocket, both movies, the police are on the sides of the aliens / rich. Weird Sex, one is obviously the shunting in Society, and the other is having sex with an alien at the end of They Live.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Any more?
No, I'm done.
Okay, well, the one I'm actually going with, and I'm taking a leaf out of your book, Victoria, this week, and trying to bring something a bit highbrow to the podcast.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll be quoting one of England's greatest ever poets, Shelley.
Yeah.
For this, who the phrase, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, is attributed to. What he actually said in 1821 was, "To him that hath, more shall be given. And from him that hath not, the little that he hath shall be taken away. And sometimes he shalleth be eateneth in the sexorgieth."
He was into that, though.
He was. He bloody loved it. He loved the shunting, did Shelley. Right then.
You can say it because he's been dead for ages. It's fine.
So, Victoria, you lucky thing. I gave you Society. Chris got They Live. We do it chronologically. They Live came out just 3 months before Society in the UK, 1989. So, Chris, take us on a journey.
I'm going to let Vicky do this one.
Thank you, Chris.
Vicky, take us on a journey.
Are you doing They Live?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
That's okay. Everyone ready?
Yes.
We're all right. Don't want to do that again? No. Is everyone fine?
It's all good fun.
It's real. Okay. It's real. It's authentic.
All right. Here we go. an elite cabal of the wealthy and well-connected covertly ruling the world who can only be brought down by a single man and deliver a great awakening? No, it's not a QAnon recruitment ad. No, really it isn't. But John Carpenter's They Live.
All right, suppose we settle down.
That's far enough.
Where'd you get those glasses?
Tooth Fairy.
The story of a drifter who discovers through magic sunglasses that there are aliens living among us, mind-controlling the populace via television signals into the obedient and ceaseless consumerism that gives our lives meaning.
Excuse me.
Just survive.
You know, you look like your head fell on the cheese dip back in 1957.
Oh.
You see, I take these glasses off, she looks like a regular person, doesn't she, huh? Put them back on, formaldehyde face. That's what
we
got.
That's enough out of you.
I've got one that can see.
He's a tall, Caucasian male that doesn't appear armed, wearing sunglasses.
I don't like this one.
He'll stop at nothing to save the day and destroy the signal, by which I mean he'll stop for 7.5 minutes to fight the only person who's been nice to him. The end.
I swear it's 6 minutes, that fight.
Yeah, it's 5.5 to 6.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Why right. do you think it's 7?
Because I read an interview with John Carpenter where he said it's 7.5 minutes and he made it, so he knows.
I timed it.
Yeah. I mean...
Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's a long fight. It's a long fight. It doesn't matter.
It's 6 minutes.
It doesn't matter.
It's a long 6 minutes.
When I say you can't talk to you two, this is what I'm talking about.
I'm on your side.
You're not.
I'm not completely, because it's wrong.
Anyway,
yeah.
I'm going to assume that you two have seen this film before, because when you came up with this pairing, Alex, you, Chris, were very excited.
I was very excited.
About They Live.
Very excited about both films, actually, yeah.
And... you don't tend to pick things you haven't seen. No, don't say it like that. Sometimes I do, just for
the shits and giggles.
Shits and giggles.
Yeah, no, it's true. I like to. I rewatch movies more than I watch new movies.
That's it. Yeah, that's the thing.
I'm imagining these were video watches for me and Alex in our teenage years, both films, because we're too young to watch them in the cinema.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I owned, and indeed do still own, the VHS of They Live, which actually is now worth more than it was when I bought it. It's worth 30 quid on
is it?
eBay.
Did you break it out and watch it this week?
The VHS?
Yes.
No, I don't.
On what? Well, you have to go through a skip and get a video.
I've got my video player still with some videos.
Mine's in storage.
Ah, yeah. I like watching the trailers.
That's because of your massive flat. You can just step forward to put a room full of VHS cassettes. I don't have the space.
That's bullshit. He lives in the society mansion.
But the thing is, his video cover is why I thought I'd seen this, but I haven't, because I remember the video from the flat that we lived in.
Yeah,
right.
Yep.
So it's obviously quite a memorable cover. And I just thought it had been on and I'd seen it.
I was going to say, last week you weren't sure if you'd seen it. And it might have been. So, yeah, we were thinking maybe some late night in the flat.
Yeah.
You watched it on Alex's video, but no.
No, I think I would have remembered.
Yeah.
The first time watching.
Oh,
sure.
That's exciting. Yeah.
I remember watching it as a kid and not being blown away by it, but it imprinting on my memory in a big way. I honestly think this film, on a subconscious level, is responsible for my distrust of government.
Interesting.
More on QAnon later.
But I think you're right. You know, it's during that great John Carpenter run of films. And I think maybe to like a 14-year-old boy, Big Trouble in Little China was a lot more memorable than They Live.
Yeah.
And maybe even The Thing. But there are certain things that jump out at you and have stayed with me. I'm sure we'll get onto them.
Yeah, just on the QAnon front, I have spent an inordinate amount of time watching InfoWars this weekend.
Have you?
So, well, there was an interview with Roddy Piper, a 40-minute interview with Alex Jones and Roddy Piper about They Live.
Oh, no, you're joking.
Because They Live is Alex Jones's, unsurprisingly, favourite film ever. And so they talk about it for a long time. I've got some quotes. It's...
oh, I look forward to that.
Yeah.
It made me mad as hell. Yeah. But anyway.
But I do think it's a really important movie, because I do think it teaches you to question everything and this idea of whether the choices we make are really our own or whether we're influenced. And obviously Carpenter was mainly talking about TV and advertising at the time. But now, I mean, if it's ever a film been more prescient today than it was when it was made, because we literally are being influenced more so by the internet than ever.
Yeah.
I mean, we are giving away our data, which companies are then using back at us to make us consume.
Yeah.
So it's such an important movie.
Yeah, I can get with that. Shall I talk you through some of the background?
Yes, please.
Chris may correct me about 5 minutes versus 6 minutes, or let's see. All right, so here we go.
Let it go.
See, that's, yeah, I can't. That's why we're not good friends. I don't mean we're not good friends. We're not good as friends. Do you know what I mean? We're bad for each other.
I don't think anything you mean is going to help the next hour.
All right, here we go. So They Live was the second project in John Carpenter's...
That's wrong.
Oh, no!
I'm joking.
See, you've made her all tense now, look.
I'm a bit nervous now. Right. Yeah. Well done. Four-picture deal with Alive Films and Universal, which began with Prince of Darkness, which I have not seen. But you must have seen, Chris.
Yes.
Is it good?
It's good. It's frightening.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, it originated from the story Narda, which was in Eclipse Comics' Alien Encounters by Ray Nelson and artist Bill Ray. John Carpenter read that, responded to it, as at the time he was very angry about the state of Reagan's America.
Did anyone read? It was actually, the comic was based on a short story that Ray Nelson wrote.
I'm getting to that.
Have you read it?
No, but I read the comic.
Oh, you read the comic?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I read the story.
There's massive tits in it, which really put me off. So Narda, or I can't remember what he's called, he goes to the door and his girlfriend answers the door and she's just like two tits and a wig. And she's like, oh, come in. I was like, what?
Have you ever read a comic book before? This is not a unique circumstance.
I was like, is that normal? Is this a pornographic comic? She's just...
Just a comic for kids.
Just a comic for kids. So he seeks out the source material, which is a short story by Ray Nelson called 8 o'clock in the morning. And in 8 o'clock in the morning, a man wakes up from a hypnotist trance, realises that aliens are controlling our lives, and he's got until 8 o'clock in the morning to solve this problem. So are you going to say you have read the short story?
Yeah, I have read the short story.
Okay.
It's really similar, except the aliens are... It's very short. It's only 6 pages long.
Right.
The aliens are lizard cannibals in the short story. Who George takes out one by one. But then he does break into the TV studio where the signal they're emitting comes from and orders, sort of gets on the telly and orders the world to see these aliens and kill them. Mm. And then he dies.
Okay.
So there are a lot of similarities, especially, you know, the key scene here where he sees all the signs around. All those signs are taken from this book.
Oh, that's interesting, because in the comic he dies as well at the end. It doesn't work.
Weirdly, if you watch They Live... over the weekend and you are a Stephen King fan and you felt it was familiar, Stephen King wrote a short story called The 10 O'Clock People, which is about how people withdrawing from smoking, the chemical imbalance of nicotine in their body causes them to see rich people who are these bat creatures. And it's pretty much exactly like They Live. And Stephen King talks about, he said, this story had one of the shortest gestation periods of any of his pieces. And my question to Stephen King is, was it the 95 minutes it took you to watch They Live? Because there's no reference to him going, it's basically They Live, but it is They Live.
Naughty Stephen.
That is fair. So John Carpenter, he gets the film rights to the comic and the short story, and he writes the screenplay under the pseudonym Frank Armitage, which is an allusion to H.P. Lovecraft, Henry Armitage being a character in the Dunwich Horror. He expands the story to involve his feelings on politics, the social and cultural context of his time. Now, in an interview, this is where I got a lot of my research from, Starlog magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I went there for you. Mm. He says, quote, "I'm disgusted by what we've become in America. I truly believe there is brain death in this country." And about television in particular, he said, "I quickly realised that everything we see is designed to sell us something. My awareness became so acute after a while that I couldn't even watch MTV." Which I think is a weird example to put a light on.
This is what Alex Jones was talking about on InfoWars. He was saying, why is it that some of us are awake and we know that the signal is out there and yet everyone else is sleepwalking through this life?
Let's just take a moment to call Alex Jones a cunt and move on. Fuck that guy.
Right. However, having watched a lot of InfoWars, I will say...
Oh, my God. Please don't be doing this. Don't.
Here we go.
Do you remember we had that drunken row? And I was like, you need to be careful.
You think I'm vulnerable to
these messages.
Yes,
I do. Yeah.
You will join a cult of that, I'm sure.
No, but look, put it like this. I do think there is a tendency for people to sleepwalk through life and have the government distract us. I mean, if you think about it like this, like... The government basically is creating, even now, a huge disparity between the rich and the poor and making a large segment of the population so desperate and so having to concentrate on hand-to-mouth, basically,
mm-hmm. Yes.
That they don't ever have the time to question the bigger picture about how we ended up here and what is happening.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, I thought this might be interesting and fun to talk about you know, like your human brain can't compute like a very big number.
Mm.
So we all know that like the 99% and the 1%. So the most current fact I could statistic is the top 1% of households. And this was done by a Swiss investment firm. So it's in euros. So a top household is considered one with wealth of 1.2 million euros or more. They own 44% of the world's total wealth, right? But they try and think about billionaires, because there's a lot of talk about, you know, obviously no one needs a billion of anything really. So Jeff Bezos is worth now, and because of COVID, probably more, 188 billion. But human brains struggle to conceptualize a billion because it sounds like a million. We can sort of deal with a million. So look at the difference between a billion and a million. So these are just some fun things that go around the internet. If a million seconds is 12 days, a billion seconds is 32 years. Can you believe that, right?
Wow.
And if you saved $100 a day for the rest of your life, it would take you 27,000 years to save $1 billion. Right? And my last one is, if you counted to a billion, allowing 3 seconds per number with no breaks, because obviously the bigger, the further up you go, the longer it takes to say the numbers, it would take you 95 years to count to a billion with no breaks. How mental is that?
That's a lot.
It's a lot. And Jeff Bezos has got 188 billion of those dollars. So
I'd say that's too much.
I think it's too much.
On the Amazon and the Jeff Bezos front, because I did end up like just because this was an article that I found today as I was researching this. So $11,000 a second is spent on Amazon. Jeff Bezos, as you said, richest man in the world, $178 billion. And yet as a company, and this is what we're talking about, this is what John Carpenter is talking about in this, like Amazon paid 2.1% tax on 13.7 billion pounds worth of sales in the UK last year because of their offshore structure of how they do their accounts. And then you sort of go, well, this is how is that allowed? How is it that now we've got this deficit because of coronavirus that Rishi Sunak is gonna end up taxing us, the people, to make up that money and letting them continue to pay 2.1% tax on that amount of money? There's your money.
Messaging to people that are benefit scroungers, quote marks. Have you paid your taxes? Have you done your self-assessment tax return? And if you haven't, you fucking worm. And you get dragged. It's like, you're coming after me for 200 quid. Like, hard. Yeah. It's not right. So bring it back to the like present day-ish. In 2015, John Carpenter said about They Live, it's a documentary, it's not science fiction. The same problem still exists. He qualifies it by saying, I'm a very happy capitalist. I love my country. I love the system that we're in, but not without some restraints, which is a very fair point and a very grown-up thing to say, which to me is good because it sort of tempers the sort of naivety that I think is in They Live a little, which is not his fault. It's just he was born in a very different time.
Yeah, I also saw him, you reminded me, I saw him talking about the fact, he said, I'm very pro-democracy apart from on my film sets and at home with my children when I'm a dictator.
Yeah. Let's quickly just dip into this. So the film, as Alex has mentioned, has been co-opted by a select group of right-wing extremists, also known as wankers, as an allegory for Jewish media control. And so this prompted John Carpenter to tweet, They Live is about yuppies and unrestrained capitalism. It has nothing to do with Jewish control of the world, which is a slander and a lie. But this trope that shadowy figures control the world and that sometimes they are Jewish people has been around for a very, very long time. And the case of They Live isn't helped by the connection with H.P. Lovecraft, a known racist and anti-Semite who was, quote, physically repulsed by Jews. So that doesn't help, but I do take John Carpenter's word for it.
But it's been co-opted by various groups. Agreed that there is a select group of right-wing people. And as John Carpenter tweeted, yes, that's true. But so many different people, like where it was just anti-capitalist at the time and the liberals who sort of went, look at this film. Now, you know, you can apply it to so many different things. And
one of the most famous images from the 2016 election on the left was using They Live imagery where Donald Trump was one of the aliens.
Yeah.
And that poster was everywhere, plastered all over LA.
I think you have to be very careful because I think the most valuable tool that seems to have been used by governments is to make the idea of conspiracy theories something fringe and something stupid and something crazy. Whereas in reality, all a conspiracy theory is actually analysing a situation, looking at the evidence and coming to a conclusion that sometimes isn't what the status quo is. And I think being able to just write people off who question the status quo as nut jobs, oh, you're one of those conspiracy theorists, it helps maintain explain what we have now rather than actually letting people go, well, that doesn't seem right.
I agree to up to a point. I think it's more nuanced. I think it's a handy tool to dismiss anyone with criticism as a conspiracy theory nut job. Mm. But there are some right nutters in that group. And so it's not helpful to lump in, the Twin Towers brought down by a series of government-sanctioned explosions, with people are like, my tax bill seems a bit off. Like, I think that's fair enough. So casting of They Live, John Carpenter is a huge wrestling fan.
And he likes wrestling, weed, and video games.
he's all right.
And it's been like that for 20 years. Nearly 20 years ago, we wanted to interview him when I was at Hot Dog magazine. And yeah, his agent just told us he's getting stoned and playing video games, and he's really got no interest in talking to anyone. We were disappointed, but it was like, yeah, that's quite cool. Fair enough. He's done it. He's done his work. Yeah.
There's your headline.
John Carpenter said of Roddy Piper, he has life written all over him. He has been hit so many times that he's really broken up. He even walks funny because his pelvis was shattered and his back was wrenched. He's the toughest guy I've ever met. You could run a truck into Roddy and he would still be standing.
And he's lived a life not too dissimilar to the one that John Nader is living before he became a successful wrestler.
Yeah, he's moved around a lot.
He said he would when he was a kid he would dumpster dive, which is what John Nader does at one point in this film. Literally, you'd go looking for food in dumpsters.
Yeah,
I like the fact he talks about him. He says that he liked Piper's unpolished simplicity and the lack of a larger than life movie star charisma, and I do think that really works in this film because it just accelerates this idea of him being this everyman and creates an even bigger gap between him and the aliens. And I don't think he's a bad actor.
But isn't it mad that he picked the most over-the-top loud wrestler to play an earnest, quiet man? It just complete counter-programming in that decision.
Yeah, I didn't know. I don't know who Roddy Piper is or was. I wasn't interested in. So I was just really judging him as an actor, which may not be wise.
No. He kind of lost his job over this as well. WWF, when they found out he was going to go and make this movie, the guy who was running the wrestling at the time, Vince McMahon Jr., told him to turn it down and said to him, if you don't do this film within 4 weeks, I'll get you another movie at the same price. And Roddy said to him, yeah, but it won't be with John Carpenter directing. Mm-hmm. And so he left, did it, they kicked him out, and then they ended up begging him to come back because he was such a big star off the back of this film. They wanted him back in wrestling. So this was the best thing that happened to him.
Okay.
Yeah. He talks about They Live in his InfoWars interview, does Roddy Piper, and he says it's kind of the Cliff's Notes for what's going on. I'll leave it there.
Please do.
Okay.
Please stop watching InfoWars.
Yeah, this podcast is turning into an advert for that, and I don't want it back.
Right. That's my red line.
Right,
to be
that's it. I'm going to stop.
No, it's interesting, and it's important to present another side. But it's just when you make broad statements like this is just what's going on. It's hard to disagree with that. So I think that's how they get by.
And before he passed away, he had been hit in the head a lot.
Yeah.
So the role of Frank was written especially for Keith David and for the female lead of Holly. We've got Meg Foster, John Carpenter say, Meg is a terrific actress and she has great eyes, which is true.
Yeah.
But also I wanted Roddy to be surrounded by the best actors possible. That's good directing. I think that is everything I've got.
The only other thing I'll say is I want to hark back to our podcast on the underrated Tim Burton movie, Mars Attacks.
Oh, really?
Because I don't even remember. I was talking about the Alex Cox script for Mars Attacks.
Yes.
It didn't happen. So I read the script for that show. I read the 1989 version, but I believe he was working on it as early as 1985. Now, if you remember this script, it involved aliens invading and enslaving the populace in shanty towns, and Martians being added to TV shows and putting adverts everywhere, encouraging us to consume Martian food, drink and drugs. And it turned out that Mars was being in danger of being buried under the weight of unsold consumer goods. So they'd come here, wiped out the dinosaurs, started Project Earth so that we'd evolve into a planet that would consume. And it was a film that was all about capitalism, imperialism and criticism of American values, which makes me think John Carpenter might have read that before putting pen to paper here.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
I really wish they'd made that Mars Attacks.
Anything. So shall we go through the film?
Let's do it.
All right. So we meet John Narda, a drifter. He's unemployed. He's riding the railways. He's looking for a job. At this point, little sidebar, did anybody else used to play job centres when they were little with the slips of paper? So I had
This sounds like it's in very bad taste.
It's a buried memory. Right. Me and my sister, we used to spend a lot of time in the job centre with my mum,
right,
who was looking for work. And so when you play games, you know, like you play, just imaginary games, like kids today, let's play it being superheroes or whatever. Me and Rachel would play job centres and we'd put the little bits of paper on the wall and I would sit behind the desk and have a bad attitude and Rachel would get down the bit of paper that said what she wanted to do for a living and I'd be like, okay, well, you've got to go for this interview, I guess. But my mum and dad they didn't want to shame us, I suppose. I don't know. They were not like, we do not play job centres. The job centre wasn't a shameful. It was like, this is where we go to get jobs and money.
Right.
So that's what we used to play. I thought I'd share that and see if that...
I had a SNES. So.
I played football.
We should have been outside. You're right. It's weird looking back on it now. I just thought maybe we could have some common ground, get his friendship back on track.
Was it always you behind the desk?
No, we'd swap.
Okay.
And this will make you laugh. Because we were children, obviously it's like you could have any job you wanted. I can't believe I could.
What sort of job?
I wanted to...
What did you want to be?
Could you get a job at the job centre? Was that an option?
I wanted to be a model. I was like six.
It could happen. Oh. It could still happen.
Oh, no.
Wow.
Oh, that's really sad.
Wow.
Oh, my heart is racing. I can't believe I've just told you that. But yeah, I wanted to be a model because I thought it looked easy and I thought you got loads of money. And I think that's true. I'm not saying it's easy, but I think you do get quite a lot of money.
You do. And it is pretty easy.
I think you can say it's easy. Don't offend all the models who listen to our show.
That's 100% what I was trying to do. I don't want to be accused. No, not accused. Sorry, I don't want to not respect your feelings about how hard your job is. I'm sure it's a lot of standing around and you're isolated from your family.
Fuck models.
Oh, dear. Anyway, let's talk about this film.
Yeah.
So... John gets a job on a building site. So this is where he meets Frank, played by Keith David. Frank has got a family, which is going to be important. It's going to put him in contrast to John. And Frank takes John to Justiceville, which is an informal settlement of people who are homeless. But this did irk me a bit. It's calm and it's quite peaceful and there's plenty of food and solidarity and good feeling among these people. So They Live was shot on location in downtown LA. Not all of it, but like lots of it. And John Carpenter said he could sympathise with the hopeless plight. This is writing in the 80s, you wouldn't say that now. Of the homeless. And he said, quote, "After working in Hollywood for so many years, I've realised that true success has nothing to do with how much money you make. It has to do with the principles by which you live. So in that respect, I actually feel much safer among the street people in downtown LA than among the millionaires in Beverly Hills." Which is either quite patronising towards poor people or very damning of rich people.
Well, Roddy Piper says they actually, in that scene, used a lot of genuine homeless people.
Yeah they did.
Mm.
Yeah. They had to pay off the local gangs as well.
Yeah. To stop them wrecking their trailers. Yeah. Yep.
So this is where John first encounters the broadcasts of the hacker. And the TV signals are being jammed with a broadcast that's trying to alert us to the fact that we are all slaves. So it sets up pretty early, maybe too early, just to be as a first-time viewer, that all the information is given to us pretty quickly. There is a transmitter transmitting a signal. This signal can and must be destroyed. Mm-hmm. So that's fine, but there's the journey that our hero is going to go on. And you could make an argument for holding back some of that information, perhaps, to create a bit of suspense.
Yeah. I like the advert where the woman picks up a lump of cheese with a very long fingernail. That happens around now. Did you see that? She's got fake nails on and she just, like, there's a lump of cheese next to her and she just jams the nail into the cheese and pops it in her mouth. It's possibly the most horrifying scene in it because if you know anything about hygiene, it's a fact that it's more hygienic to lick the bowl of a public toilet than it is to bite your fingernails. You just get funnier looks. but it is genuinely very unhygienic.
On the Blu-ray that Studio Canal put out about 5 years ago, they've got all the adverts in full, and they're very funny, actually. They're very clever satires of those 80s adverts that we all know and remember and love, just with a punchline of each of them, that the person you think's really good-looking or perfect is actually an alien.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought some of them were real.
Then they've done their job.
Yeah, I just saw not in his mindset at all. Like, I think he's quite innocent, John Carpenter, to make this film and be like, look, adverts. It's like, yeah, I know.
I like that in this scene when he's watching the telly for the first time, he's meeting the other sort of homeless people. We've got the actor George Buck Flower.
Okay.
Are you aware of his work?
Is he the priest?
No, he's the homeless guy who ends up he's the turncoat.
Oh, yeah, I want to talk about that because I didn't quite get that, but we'll wait until he pops up again.
Sure. He plays a drifter in this film, and I went through... He plays one of the most famous drifters in film history. We'll get to that in a bit. But I went through his 162 IMDb credits. Most of the people he's played don't have names. This is what he's credited as. Flasher, drunk, bum, tramp, vagrant, drifter, drunk, bum number one, bum, wino, rich tramp, hobo, homeless man, drunken man, homeless man, homeless man, bearded man, homeless man, wino. So he had a thing. But he is
Stick
the drunk.
To what you know.
He is the drunk homeless guy in Back to the Future that sees the DeLorean disappear and then come back.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is probably his most famous role, even though he doesn't really speak. Anyway, that's George Buck Flower.
George Buck Flower, everybody.
There's a bit here around this point where, because I love the script to this, I think there's some great lines in it, but there is a bit here which is not good, really not good. When Frank is talking to John, and John's sort of going, we should find out what's going on. You know, I want to investigate the church. And Frank says to him, I'm walking a white line. To which John replies, that's the worst place to walk because that's the middle of the... No, he goes, white lines are in the middle of the road. That's the worst place to drive. I did a bit of digging. I'm walking a white line isn't a phrase at all. There's walking a fine line. There's walking the line, but there isn't walking a white line. So my problem is that if you are going to make up a new phrase because you've got your comeback already written...
Yeah.
Then you have to have the comeback make sense. Because
I thought it was he has to walk that delicate balance of trying to keep on the right side of white people, and John just wasn't listening. That's honestly what I thought. He's like, what can I do? I've got like a
Can I actually paraphrase a film from 1984 now?
Go on.
Walk on the road. Walk left side, you okay. Walk right side, you okay. Walk down middle road, get squished, just like grape. Same with karate. You just do karate, you okay. You know do karate, you okay. You maybe karate, get squished, just like grape.
I think that's what he means.
I do too.
I don't. I don't. But I'm sort of pleased that I was here for that.
Yeah, I'm glad that happened.
That was amazing.
Apologies to the late great Pat Morita.
I guess my problem is he goes, I'm walking a white line. And then John goes, that's the worst place to drive. And Frank should go, I'm walking though. So I'm actually walking. I'm not even driving.
True.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. We're not going to be friends.
But yeah, I'm so pleased I brought it up for that.
More on the actual film after a short break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found.
LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
So there is a resistance movement being organised from the church that borders the informal settlement.
Like that.
But before we can find out too much about that, the camp is raised. So there's a book called They Live from 2010 by someone called Jonathan Latham. And he makes a very good point, which is by depicting the homeless of Justiceville as weary and long-suffering, you can only read the destruction of the camp as like totalitarian overkill. And that's a really, I find that a very interesting point because the homeless people in this informal settlement, you are meant to feel they're not feisty, they're not rude, they're depicted as vulnerable, weak, so that you feel bad that when the camp is raised, you don't think, well, they kind of, you know, they had it coming or they were up to no good. And the resistance movement is moved sort of off site. There's no threat to the aliens from the shelter itself. Which initially annoyed me because when John Corbett was about, hey, you can trust the homeless, it's like, I find that attitude irksome because I think it's this idea that there's valour amongst poor people and that to be poor, you don't get to be shitty and greedy and everything like everybody else does because there's honour in being poor. And whilst there may be, I think it's very one-sided. Yeah. Like, oh, if you live on the streets, then you must have a cold or something.
For me, just watching that scene where the police trashed the camp, it just felt, it was more uncomfortable now watching it than it was when I watched it as a kid, just because I think we've spent the year watching the police on the news using excessive force and a militarized police on the streets dealing with riots. And it just felt like, wow, I felt like I'd seen this on the news.
Yeah. So in the aftermath of that, John steals the sunglasses, the magic sunglasses, and so then we get into our film, basically. When you put them on, the world is in black and white, billboards tell you to obey, marry and copulate, newspapers and magazines tell you to submit and stay asleep, etc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One quick thing. When he takes his sunglasses out of the box and he goes, I'm going to want that box later.
Yeah.
Not a big thinker, isn't John? Because he goes, I'm going to hide the box of sunglasses that I want for later in a full bin that is going to be picked up by a trash machine.
I agree with you.
A trash machine.
Whatever that is. A bin lorry.
Trash machine. One of those trash machines.
But also, when the trash machine picks him up later, he's got the only bin lorry ever that's only got paper in it. There's no, like, old eggs or... fucking nappy.
He's also in a bin lolly. Trash machine and bin lolly. Where the driver, for some reason, basically that whole sequence where he gets tipped out of the machine is John Carpenter going, that'll look cool. I've got a great shot for that. Because there is no reason to fill your lorry and then tip it up. You wait until you've got to the dump
before you tip it up. I believe
it's just like, yeah, it looks kind of cool, him sliding out, John, but you didn't need it. It doesn't make any sense.
I was saying to Alex beforehand, I kind of would love to see this film for the first time again for this scene. So what was it like the first time you see the world?
Stylistically, I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, it looks like, cool, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, look, it's so good that it's black and white. Mm. I don't know, I understand that it's actually more of a device just to help you move between the worlds, but the fact that it is black and white, initially I was like, I wish the whole film was black and white because it looks so cool. Mm. And it is funny as well, like the advert for Come to the Caribbean and it's just actually Marianne Copulate. I think that's very funny.
Yeah.
The best one is the cash in his hand, which just says, this is your God.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's great that it's black and white, but also I was thinking this time watching it, it's almost sad we don't get the colour version, because when you see the behind the scenes pictures and what they used on the poster, they look amazing. That this red, blue and silver that the aliens are coloured with,
yeah,
they look so cool.
Yeah, you see it at the end, but yeah, it would be great to see it throughout. But I think John Carpenter, it was intentional. He was sort of suggesting that the aliens colourised Earth, like they brought it. I didn't quite understand that, but it is a quote that he said.
Yeah, so. I read that, and then but then you feel that's a good thing, so yeah. I don't get it.
Yeah,
and that's our friend Jeff Imada from the Mortal Kombat episode movie. He plays pretty much every alien in this film. When there's just one alien in shot, he plays men, women, the president, and he's really short. Jeff Imada, he's only 5'6", so watching behind the scenes footage, it's quite funny. Like when he plays one of the cops coming up in a minute, he's standing on a box to stand next to Roddy Piper, who's like 6'4". So yeah, we've got one man as all of those aliens.
So yeah, and the aliens, like you said, they've got this like ghoulish look about them and metallic skin. And they I thought they were good because they don't look too familiar, but they do look sort of like you could get used to them. Do you know what I mean? Like, not too scary, but obviously alien in that sense.
Well, the woman who's boinking one at the end does not hop off that quickly. So she's clearly used to it.
I'm guessing the guy, you can speak to this, Vicky, was he all in?
Wait a minute.
No, don't.
Yeah, that's it. You were sort of lodged in place. Oh, yeah. Because do you always not have spines on the end that affix you?
Like a cat.
So like a cat. So the inside, if she moved, she would have ripped it all out.
Oh. Mark Addy's got a lot to answer.
Yeah, it's great though at this point where he just literally starts kicking ass. He doesn't mess.
It's good and it's not because...
No, it's good.
He just blows his cover so quickly. Mm. Like he can see them, the aliens, and then he's like, hey guys, I don't give a shit if you know that I can see you. So they're like, we've got a live one.
He becomes a blunt instrument now with shades of his wrestling persona. This is why suddenly you see, oh, this is why you've cast the wrestler, because
yeah,
he's a monster now.
But let's talk about very quickly. He is a lone wolf on a mission to destroy the conspiracy, which feeds into a lot of QAnon bullshit, that there's one man that can bring it down.
But also a lot of John Carpenter films do that, though. Ordinary man in extraordinary circumstances and the unlikely hero who's got to rise to the occasion.
And you know who else is that? Ronald fucking Reagan. Because Ronald Reagan, the trick to him is that a lack of experience can be a strength. Same with Donald Trump. Like, I'm not a career politician. I'm just one of you guys. Mm. So John Nada is also the same. He's just like this lone wolf with no experience in bringing down an alien master race, but he's the guy for the job. So John Carpenter's depiction of a hero is not, in my opinion, not that far from the man that kicked it all off for him in the first place, Ronald Reagan.
I'd agree with you there, because also I worry as this film goes on that the solution is quite a right-wing solution, is it simply guns.
Yeah.
And I feel like John Carpenter is better than that. But there's nothing else aside from shooting people and shooting things in this film to solve the problem.
Yeah, by yourself.
But that said, I would never have watched this movie if, like, the message hadn't been disguised as a film about guns and aliens. And that's why I ended up watching They Live. If it was just a comment on Reaganism and capitalism, I'd have gone, no.
Yeah, but there is a wider point to be made about films that... parrot this idea that one person can make a difference when actually real change is achieved collectively. Boring but true. Like, you are not going to be given this one moment in your life where it all hangs on what you do next. That is not the way it works.
Yeah. That makes good cinema, though.
Yeah, I know. It is boring to be like, guys, we need another steering group meeting about the revolution. Yeah, I get that. I get that. Yeah, I haven't written team meeting four.
A lot of films revolve around a hero up against the odds.
So then John randomly kidnaps Meg Foster and is a right dick to her. I think she's brilliant in this. And the scene where he's kidnapped her and they've gone back to her house, this scene, and full plaudits to John Carpenter for writing this, because there's an interesting dynamic where John wants Holly to put the glasses on to see what's going on. But because he's forcing her to do it, the point is that your enlightenment must be consensual. Otherwise, it's just the same as what the aliens are doing.
Well, also, it's a great... line that stops her just putting the glasses on, because you know this situation would be solved, at least at this point when you think she's a good guy, if she just put the glasses on. And you're like, well, why doesn't she just put the glasses on? And she says the line, she implies that you've got a gun, so if I don't see what you want me to see, I will still see it anyway.
Yeah.
So there's no way of proving that point through the glasses, which is really clever.
Yeah, it is.
What's great about her in this film as well is that you can't read her at any point.
Because of her eyes.
It's never quite clear what... I think she nicked Rebecca De Mornay's eyes from last week.
Yeah, she did.
But it's never quite clear where she's coming from at any point in this film until the end.
She's certainly not as black and white as Evelyn Evelyn, rather, from Masters of the Universe, which is what I remember her from.
Exactly.
Also... you do have to love a girl who says to her kidnapper, I'm thirsty, and then comes back with a crisp white wine. And I'm like, yes, Holly, I'm fucking thirsty.
But then she smashes it.
She smashes it and then she pushes him out of a fucking window. That's awesome.
Upper body strength does she have?
Because
she just throws him through that window. I mean, either that or that glass is dangerous. I mean, how many party guests have you lost from them just sort of leaning on the window casually? Hey, thanks for having me.
I think he was being kind, but he said on the commentary that she hit harder than Andre the Giant.
Oh, nice. So that puts John back on the run. And here we get to, he's got the rest of the glasses from the trash machine.
Unnecessary.
And he has a huge fight with Frank, who, as I've mentioned, is the only person that's been nice to him. Starts the fight by giving him a paycheck, which, I'm not being a horrible capitalist, he didn't really go to work. So he has done you a massive fucking favour, and then proceeds... the time to be confirmed, I believe it's 7.5 minutes because John Carpenter told me that. Uh-huh. You think it's five, you
six.
Think it's six.
I
timed it at 5 minutes, 30 seconds. It starts at 56 minutes 10 and ends at 1 hour, 1 minute and 40 seconds.
I will say I did not enjoy it, but I understand its place. It's there instead of them having sex, is what I will say. Because it forces an intimacy, because the scene after it is the classic, we've had sex, so let's share some secrets, but they're not going to go down that road, so they have a massive fist fight.
I mean, it's interesting. He left 5 pages clear in the script.
Just blank?
Blank.
What? With an arrow saying, go, skip to page something. Are you joking?
I'm not joking. He left 5 pages clear in the script and said... to his producers, we're going to have a 5-page fight here. Ugh. He dedicated 5 days to shoot it before he had anything written. And then they spent 2 weeks, because he said that's why he hired Rowdy Roddy Piper. He spent 2 weeks with Roddy Piper and Keith David choreographing it, making sure it had a story, the fight. Their inspiration was John Wayne's The Quiet Man. Have you seen The Quiet Man?
No.
There's a great scene where he fights another guy all over town. And then what he wanted it to be was like a real fight, not a flashy fight like you know, was the thing that Arnie, Seagal, Jean-Claude Van Damme were doing and at the end of the 80s. So, and he wanted it, he said he wanted it to mean something, to be between two friends. I think what you mean, you putting it in place of sex. But
it's good. I mean, there are two ways of looking at it. First of all, I think the story is good because it goes from just a bit of a fight to a period where it does feel like at least Keith David, Frank, feels like he's in a fight for his life. It sort of escalates to a point where the look on his face is like, I have to survive this now. And then it goes into the funny zone where Roddy Piper puts the plank of wood through the car window and goes, it's literally like, oh, geez, I'm sorry. This has escalated fast. And then it sort of carries on.
It reminds me of one of your jokes that goes on too long. You know, when you keep pushing
it.
And sometimes they come back round to be funny.
And sometimes
but more often times they don't.
But eventually they do. Just given enough time. I mean, I'd have put 12 minutes of fight in. Eventually it comes back around. I agree with Vicky, though. The problem with this fight is ultimately there's no jeopardy because you know that he's not going to kill him. You know no one's going to die. And so what are we watching it for? For the appreciation of the fight? Yeah, as a kid I was like, this is brutal. I got bored as a kid and I got bored again now. Mm-hmm.
I think what's interesting about it is, I don't know, if you put yourself in Frank's position, Frank doesn't want to know. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to put those sunglasses on because he doesn't want to get involved. He wants to continue with his life, looking after his family, ignorant of what's happening around him. And it's that question that comes back in The Matrix, doesn't it? Would you want to be unplugged?
Right, but once he is, he's like, fucking hell, let's go to work. He doesn't sort of go, I'm really furious now because you've made me wear these glasses. He's sort of, once he's seen it, he's like, thank you, I'm now awake. Personally, to put myself in Frank's position, I'd have just put the fucking glasses on first thing. Like, if he'd gone, I'm going to fight you if you don't put these glasses on. I've got the glasses on.
Yeah, it's the same scene as with Holly. If you're going to fight me with your bare hands and kill me, it's the same as a gun, no?
So what's if someone came out to you and said, put these glasses on, would you do it?
Yeah.
Why?
Like glasses? I look good in glasses.
You should be a model.
I've heard it's pretty easy.
A lot of work. It is a lot of work. Slovenian philosopher, I hope I'm going to do his name justice, Slavoj Zizek talks about this endless fight scene. And he says it is a metaphor for the struggle to achieve enlightenment.
Okay.
It's that you must force yourself to do it and that freedom hurts.
I also think there's a patronising aspect to it. I think earlier in the film, the white man is telling the black man to be patient, which is really not his place to tell him that when they're talking about work. And then here, it's like the white man telling the black man who is oppressing him.
Yeah.
And I think there's an element of that to this fight as well, which is why Frank is fighting back and not letting this bloke condescend and patronise him and control him.
Mm. It is what it is. Then, so after, they get a room together and open up because of their intimacy.
I'm not daddy's little boy anymore.
Yeah, man, that, I just was like, what's happening here? A bit of backstory about his dad. And so John Carpenter says about John, he believes his wife was killed by unintentional acceleration, which is something that happens with cars because he doesn't say what happened to his wife. Just that she's no longer around. But he does say a lot about his dad, and I didn't understand what was going on at all. We find out at this point that some of the humans have joined in with the aliens for money. So it's not quite the one-sided invasion that you might want to think it is. Apparently the line, it comes up later, but the line, we all sell out every day, is something that a real Universal executive said because he didn't see the threat in people selling out because he's just, that's so normal to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Universal wanted the aliens to be like, be cannibals like in the story.
Right.
Because they didn't think this was frightening. And as Carpenter said, as if taking your humanity wasn't threatening enough.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to join the resistance. Here is Holly again. She apologises to her kidnapper for nearly killing him because patriarchy. I fucking hate it. I'm so sorry about what I did to you. He kidnapped you so you can do what you like to him.
But he was right. The man was right.
The man was right, but we don't know that anyway. So at this point, we're with the resistance and they're kind of tooling up, but they don't have enough and they're aware that they aren't fully equipped to like take on these aliens. Things take a massive left turn. The explosion in the building where they are, I thought was brilliant. Out of nowhere, the thing blows. blows up and it's like, well, okay, it's on. We've got to go and get these aliens. But then I was like, there's a portal that's been opened up by a wristwatch and we're in an underground cavern and then we're at a gala.
See, that's my favourite bit. I really love this.
Okay.
You know, my favourite part of the movie Us, which I didn't really like, granted, is the line at the start where it says there are something about there are thousands of miles of tunnels beneath the continental United States. Many have no known purpose at all. This idea of an entire subterranean world.
Oh, you do know that that's a QAnon trope, don't you? And it's not true. And you know that they
there
say
is,
that.
There's one at Disney.
Yeah, sure. But paedophiles don't use it to traffic kids. They just don't.
You can't put words in my mouth. You didn't say paedophiles use them.
He didn't say that.
I'm not saying there's loads of paedophiles running around under cities pulling kids down into the sewers.
That's Pennywise.
Jeez.
We don't talk enough about normal stuff. And then you say something like this. I'm like, how far down this madness rabbit hole have you gone?
Bit too far.
Let me pull it back. You see a couple of security guards in this scene downstairs in the tunnel.
Yeah.
They're holding the PKE monitor.
Oh, no, 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 they're
Why
not. Did you not let her guess? I wanted to know if she'd spotted it. Granted, she hadn't.
I think her reaction.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
It's so cool. It's the one Egon
has. Are they really? The real one?
Yeah.
It's the same prop.
Why? Mm. Oh, I love it.
Props do get used over and over again in films.
I love that. Oh, that's made me feel really cheered. So where are we? So, yeah,
oh, did you spot Al Leong as well?
I didn't spot him. I spotted him in the credits, but I didn't spot him in the film.
Yeah, he's running down a corridor away from an explosion. You barely see him, but he's there.
Classic him.
Yeah.
So I think, isn't this the man you wanted to talk about? He's called Gilbert, the turncoat.
Played by Buck Flowers.
So my question is this. So when we meet him at the start of the camp and he's watching TV on the sofa, is he at that point a spy for the aliens pretending to be homeless who then sells out the church or at least tells them where the church is and that's why the police raid happens? Or is he a homeless person who wants to be elevated to the upper class and so sells out his fellow man
to do something,
get in with the aliens? Like, what is he?
I mean, I thought the second thing you said, but the first thing's quite a good theory.
I thought he was a double agent.
Right.
He was working both sides.
Fair
and
enough.
He always had been.
That's better.
Yeah.
Makes more sense.
It makes more sense because even if you were a homeless guy who sold out like your friends, I don't think you'd be elevated quite so far up the tree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what have they got to gain from getting him on board?
Yeah.
Unless they want as many people as possible. But yeah, no, I think that's a good theory, the spy.
So he's a spy. Good. That was my question.
John and Frank eventually get to the dish. Turns out Holly's also working the other side. Yeah.
Frank's death, man. That's so awful. Like, the fact it doesn't even happen on screen. You just see her put a gun to the side of his head as John runs off and then you hear a bang. It's dark.
Wrong.
It is
dark.
So John shoots her, shoots the dish.
Roddy Piper's very honest about his acting in this film. Well, he knows he's not an actor. He said he didn't know what he was doing. He was constantly asking them, John Carpenter and Meg Foster and everyone, Keith David, what he should be doing. And he said that this scene, he was thinking of a woman called Lorraine who dumped him and broke his heart. And he gets quite emotional in the commentary talking about this. But he said he wanted to show hurt rather than anger when he shoots her, when he realises that she's betrayed him and the entire human race.
That's better. Betrayed him. It's not about you. Anyway. The thing is, though, when he has the scene with the I'm not daddy's little boy and something about a razor blade, he does all right in that.
He's not happy with that either. He's beating himself up big time on the commentary with that, just saying, I didn't know what I was doing. I'm so sorry. You should have made me do it again.
I think it's okay.
I honestly don't mind him at all in this. I think he's good. He's good.
He reminds me of Dave Bautista when I was on the set of Guardians of the Galaxy, who that was his first huge acting job. And he, in between takes, would come over and talk to us. And he was beating himself up as well. He really thought he was ruining the film.
No,
and then you'd watch
that.
The takes and he was fantastic.
Yeah.
But he is gutted in this scene where before everything explodes, he holds up his middle finger. And it's sort of quite crooked and bent. It's not like a straight middle finger. And on the commentary said this to John Carpenter, this I wish I'd done better. It should have been straight and strong. My last defiance. And bless him, Carpenter's trying to talk him down and says, you've just been shot. You might not have the energy to hold it straight. And it's just a weird interaction.
It happens all the time. It's not as rare as you'd think, actually. And it doesn't mean anything. And I'm not hurt. And we can try again later. I'm sure is what he said. Boob shot the end.
Yeah, that's good though, where it's the alien film critic going off on TV going, George Romero and John Carpenter need to show some self-control over sex and violence in their film. Smash cut boobs.
Boobs, yeah, why not? I suppose if you want to be, or should you say it's homage to the comic, because that's mostly boobs, so end on some tits.
Yeah. But it's very Carpenter as well. Nothing's wrapped up. He doesn't really like wrapping things up and tying them with a nice little bow. And he always says it's because life isn't clean and simple. And so nor should endings be.
So wise. I just struggle with that sort of come and listen to what I've got to say. Because I think John Carpenter is a great dude and all of that, but I think the innocence is frustrating.
Do you think he's the preacher early on in the film on the street corner who's ranting and raving but no one's listening to him? Do you think that's how he sees himself?
I don't feel like... maybe how he sees himself. It's not that we're not listening. It's that we get it, but our head is in a different space.
Yeah.
And we... because he feels betrayed. What did he say? Yeah, he said, all of my values have been betrayed, whereas my values haven't been betrayed because I was born into those values. I can see that they're not ideal for the future of the human race. He said something about, and he's completely right, that nothing is built to last. And it sounds like an old man complain, but we are hurtling towards an absolute disaster because the companies that make the stuff that we're encouraged to buy, those things don't last. They don't want them to last. They don't want you to love these things. They want you to like these things so that when they break, you replace them. You don't replace the things you love.
Here's a more recent quote from him. I believe that the 80s have never ended. They're still with us today. We've never repudiated this Reaganomics idea. Everything is trickled down, but they're still among us. Yeah. And they're still making more money than ever.
And also he feels betrayed because he saw a time when an alternative was, it might have felt within grasp. And it does feel within my grasp. I would say that, like, I think we live in, there's optimism and there's hope to be had, but it's just it sort of absolves us as responsibility. If John Carpenter's message is, it's aliens making us do this. Like, there's something within us that doesn't mind in a first world, or I hate that phrase, but a global northern system, we don't mind living like this. Otherwise, I don't think we would do it. So what does it say about us without aliens controlling us that we allow these things to happen? And don't give a shit, basically. Like, I don't think we're being mind controlled.
I do, though. I think
I know you do, because it absolves you of responsibility.
It doesn't. It's not that it absolves me of responsibility. It's that, like I said at the start, I think you are preoccupied with the day-to-day grind
yeah,
that you aren't able to do what you're saying and go, actually, this needs to stop. I want to get off this merry-go-round because this is not good. It's not good for me. I'm not enjoying this.
Yeah, I think the co-opting of consumerism as the only power you've got is very dangerous as well. So, like, boycotts, I understand why people are so frustrated. I'm going to boycott this brand, I'm going to do whatever, but it doesn't take a view of the whole system, which is, if you boycott a certain brand, the person that makes the stuff for that brand is going to be, in theory, out of a job. And the company that makes that stuff, they don't give a shit. Like, they'll do something else, make their money somewhere else. Like, the whole thing needs a long, hard look at it. But that we are distracted from doing that.
Yeah.
Apart from these pockets of resistance, which are worth celebrating.
Yeah. And which hopefully will grow over time.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah.
That's all I have.
Shall we do the bits then?
Yeah, I did one other thing. Keith David said that the film opened at number one in America and then promptly disappeared. He said no one could find it.
No one.
And their local cinema.
I found it.
And he reckons it must have pissed someone off that week.
Okay.
And there was a movement at the time as well, claiming because Rowdy Roddy Piper was not always in the best shape as a wrestler. He liked to have a good time outside the ring. There was claims that they superimposed Roddy's head on someone else's body for this film, which got to him. People kept coming to him saying, that's not your body, is it, in the film? Which really upset him. So there's a conspiracy theory about the conspiracy theory movie.
I think that's how it works. And you just keep going and going and then you never leave the house.
Yep. Right, who's going to take us through the bits?
Oh, I should. Alex, what was your best scene?
Putting the glasses on for the first time and seeing the worlds. It really is a transformative moment for me when I saw it as a kid, although I probably didn't realise it then. I think it's something you want everyone to do. I think this movie should be put on the school curriculum so that kids know to question everything. Put the glasses on.
What about you?
Same. It's the most important scene in the film, as it really has to sell that high concept, and I think they nail it. It looks great. It goes on for just the right amount of time, as some other scenes might not. And it is truly terrifying and upsetting, but also funny. So
yeah, and I agree. So that is 3 for 3. Your most valuable whatever, Chris?
I'm going to pick John Carpenter. Now, this is an adaptation, and having read the story, he's taken a lot from that story. But narratively, visually, the attitude of this film, the politics, this is all John Carpenter, and I love it.
Yep. I got John Carpenter too. Just sneaking such an important social commentary into a retro sci-fi action movie. Love it. I would have not watched this movie, as I said, age 10, if it had just been about capitalism and Reaganism and consumerism. So disguising it with aliens and guns got me into it.
Mine is makeup artist Frank Carasosa for the aliens, because I like the way they look. And I was very surprised
nasty,
by how...
Nasty, aren't they?
Yeah, but also not that bad. Like,
really?
Like, no, like you could become friends with them. Do you know what I mean? Like you could get used to them.
Okay.
That's what I thought. Yeah. Like they, you wouldn't always, like the alien in Alien is terrifying.
Right.
What, aliens?
Yeah.
And you can't be friends with that alien.
No.
But this one, you think we could
come around,
work together.
Yeah, of course.
Make a bit of money.
Yeah, I'll get used to you.
I can get used to you. I can get used to so much.
Yep.
One change, Alex.
I know we often talk about how films are too long. I think They Live is too short.
Mm.
I actually think, annoyingly, it scratches the surface of so many ideas without delving into them. And I think stick 20 minutes more on this and let's find out a little bit more about these aliens and the power and the system and this other world that they've come from, what their plan is and their goal is. Little tidbits that you hear, like they're changing the atmosphere of the planet. It's like, well, is that their end goal, to wipe us out once they've used us up? I mean, what is the bigger story about these aliens? I wish there was more to it. I feel like it occasionally is too superficial for its own good.
I mentioned earlier, I kind of wish Frank had got a more noble death, but that's not my change, because I think that was very intentional by John Carpenter. But I said this earlier as well, I wish guns weren't the solution. The NRA must love this ending. And I agree with you, Alex. You know, I watched this film because it was an action movie, but I think you can have an action movie, but also have a more cerebral conclusion that satisfies the narrative, that's something that you've set up that you can pay off at the end, rather than a guy with a shotgun.
Mm, I agree. It's not my change, but I do very much agree with that. This is really simple. The humans that are cooperating, they're not part of the gang. They're being used. They're not going to be rewarded for their cooperation. They realise this, and then they're thrown back into our society, and we have to decide what we do with them.
Mm, like it.
That's it.
Very good.
Right, well, that is They Live, done and dusted. Before we talk about what we're doing next week on the show, Chris, do you have a quiz?
Well, it's good job that you've been talking about QAnon and InfoWars.
Yeah!
Because I have a conspiracy quiz.
Lovely.
Now, this is one I'm going to give credit to How Stuff Works, because I kind of nicked some of it from them. I rewrote some of the answers and things, but...
That doesn't make any sense then. That would have changed the answers.
You're getting multiple choice answers.
Right.
Okay, and some of the multiple choice answers weren't particularly good, so I've just...
So
fiddled.
You thank him and then slacking him off.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to go that far. Alex pushed me to it.
I really didn't.
Okay. Here we go. Question one. Those streams of vapour behind airplanes.
Oh, chemtrails.
No, I think you talked to us about this, didn't you?
He fucking told me about chemtrails, and he said it like, I thought he was being funny. He's like, you should check it out. But like, he's like, it's nuts. Mm. And then I checked it out, and then I'm sure I messaged you, was like, this is bad shit. And you were like, but is it though? And I was like, we can't be friends.
There's some truth in chemtrails.
There's nuts!
Well, you got it right, obviously, both of you. Some people think that the streams behind airplanes are chemicals being used to control the weather, but
it's fucking water.
There's zero proof or even evidence that chemtrails are anything other than ordinary contrails, water vapour that freezes once it hits the cold air.
Absolutely, yes. So because there's no evidence, let's just assume that it's
not true. Are you fucking kidding me? I am moving away from you. Are you joking?
I'm just saying.
If there's no evidence, then there's no evidence. An absence of evidence.
That was only question one. Question two.
Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. That's the law, right? That's a fact. This is
chill.
Like the pub. Oh,
chill.
Put the glasses on, Victoria. Wake up.
Be careful.
Why do some observers believe that the Twin Towers were rigged with explosives and were blown up as part of a massive conspiracy?
Of the way it exploded on different floors, explosives floor by floor. It shouldn't have exploded like
Number
that.
One, is it one? Our top-level Bush administrators exchanged emails about the buildings being rigged for demolition 3 weeks before the attacks. Is it number two? The buildings just mysteriously fell at once at a high-speed freefall? Or is it number three? The controlled demolition explosions are easy to identify in high-speed video replay.
Well, it's three and two a bit, but three mainly.
It's a hard question to answer because that's not what happened. But people believe it because you can see it at high speed, or they think they can see something like that.
Correct. So that's one to Vicky. What? No. You went with three. Yeah, you went with three.
Three was the right answer.
No, it was two. The buildings just mysteriously fell at once in a high-speed freefall. The idea that the towers just collapse all at once in a freefall is something that might point to carefully planned explosives, but it only takes one careful viewing from a still camera to see that the reality was the towers sadly collapse over time between 15 and 22 seconds. Some people believe that the area beneath the Denver International Airport is home to what exactly? Is it A, a nuclear bomb factory? Is it B, the headquarters of the New World Order? Or is it C, a massive neo-Nazi group plotting to take over Colorado?
The headquarters of the New World Order.
I mean, he knows. So, no, it's a massive neo-Nazi group taking over Colorado.
Alex is correct there.
I mean, what? Yeah, he already knows all this stuff.
There are murals of...
What is the New World Order, Alex? Don't answer that question. It's whatever you want it to be.
Gangster rap was devised by corporate executives for what reason, according to some folks? To help keep prisons full, to increase sales of bulletproof vests, or to boost the profit margins of drug cartels?
Oh, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, I actually don't know that one.
What was the second one?
What's the conspiracy? To increase sales of bulletproof vests.
Yeah, that.
Alex?
Yeah, that.
Wrong. The conspiracy was to keep prisons full. In 2012, an anonymous internet post dropped a bomb on hip-hop, revealing that an early 90s meeting between corporate bigwigs where rap album marketeers would agree to push hardcore gangster rap, proliferating a lifestyle that was sure to keep private prison business booming.
Okay.
Why do some people believe that the NASA moon landings were faked?
Because they're bored.
There's so many reasons. Because
I think you're going to know that one. Yeah.
No, let's do it anyway. But
the top NASA administrator in charge of the Apollo 11 mission admitted the whole thing was faked on a Hollywood movie set. The president made a verbal slip on live television indicating the landings were staged. Or the American flag in the video is flapping in what is supposedly an airless. Yeah,
they think it's the wrong direction, but that's not true.
The moon landings were faked.
Okay.
There's a belt of radiation around planet Earth that we can't pass through as humans without dying.
I'm actually worried about you.
The astronauts had trouble extending the flag rod completely, and in still pictures, this created a ripple effect, making it look as if the flag was waving. In video images, it becomes clear that the flag only moved when they were trying to plant it in the moon's surface. There's a rumour that all humans are essentially enslaved by reptilian overlords. Where did this originate? From a book by L. Ron Hubbard, from a deleted scene from the original Matrix, or with a retired English footballer?
A retired English footballer.
David Icke?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's old, though. It goes way beyond him, that wanker.
David Icke, his favourite film is They Live.
Is it? Oh, yeah. God.
It's Alex Jones' favourite film as well. He says it breaks open everything.
During the 2016 presidential election cycle.
Your face.
During the 2016 presidential election, what sparked a belief that a potential human trafficking ring operated out of a Washington, D.C. pizza restaurant? Was it leaked messages from presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's email accounts? Was it from Rush Limbaugh's radio show? Or was it a white supremacist tweet?
No, people think it's Hillary Clinton for Pizzagate, but... it isn't. This is not real.
Yeah, I'll go with Hillary.
It started with a white supremacist tweet.
Oh.
A Twitter account spouted blatantly false information about a human trafficking ring. About a month later, a deranged man showed up there with a gun to investigate the problem, blasting holes into the restaurant's interior. Authorities quickly disproved.
It is funny that it doesn't have a basement. That's the payoff to that joke. The fact that they were like in the basement of this pizza restaurant, and he turned up and he was like, "I want to see the basement."
See your basement.
And they were like, "The fucking isn't
fucking
one.
Haven't
it's,
even got one.
It's just ground. It's just ground there.
Tunnels."
Last one. What was the proof that Nirvana's lead singer Kurt Cobain died a result of murder, not suicide? Was it the handwriting at the end of his suicide note was different to the penmanship at the start? On a later album, his wife Courtney Love alluded to murdering her husband in rather vague song lyrics, or was it a now missing audio tape that caught the murderer in the act?
B.
A, the handwriting.
Vicky has won. It's A.
Oh.
But he was just high on heroin, and the more high he got, the worse his handwriting became.
That makes sense.
Right.
Congratulations, Vicky.
Oh, it feels dirty. I feel really soiled.
So you actually...
This is the trouble. This is why we fall out. Because...
more about conspiracies than me.
I am obsessed. I'm obsessed with conspiracy theorists.
She doth protest too much, I think.
I do worry about myself. Yeah. If I ever get, like, in my darker moments, I'm like, the light has gone on.
Right then, that is They Live Done. Thank you for listening. We are looking ahead to next week. Obviously, we're doing Society on Thursday. Let's look forward to that. But Chris, it's your choices for next week's show. What are we doing? What is the clue?
We've talked about QAnon here a lot. I want to talk about the status quo, and I want to paraphrase status quo. So my clue is rocking all over the universe.
Rocking all over the universe is your first clue for next week's shows. There'll be another one put on Twitter very shortly. Do follow us on Twitter at ClashPod. Do follow us on Instagram at ClashPod. And if you haven't rated and reviewed us wherever you get your podcasts, if you are able to, please do. Please subscribe, Apple, Spotify, or other. It's hugely appreciated. Back on Thursday for some fleshy action. Bye.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking out?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.